From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Today we're featuring interviews from our archives. We all know that new technology is being introduced every day, but it's important to realize that simultaneously, new ways are being developed for organizations to operate. In addition, new technologies are being developed to simulate how people think. Margaret Wheatley is an associate professor of management at Brigham Young University and the author of the book Leadership and the New Science. The new science she speaks of isn't very new at all, but her personal breakthrough came when she realized that the concepts of chaos, quantum mechanics, and space can help us better understand how human organizations work. Later, I'll talk with Bart Kosko, a professor at the University of Southern California. His article on fuzzy logic appeared in the July 1993 issue of Scientific American. Dr. Kosko discusses how to make technology reflect how we think. Margaret Wheatley's book, Leadership and the New Science, Learning About Organization from an Orderly Universe, takes a different view of organizations and the people in them. It seemed essential that she begin by explaining just what is the new science.
The new science is a new way of looking at things. It's one of the basic shifts that scientists have made, partly because we can now observe 43 times more than we used to be able to with our naked eye. Observe more of the universe. Scientists are now seeing things more in terms of wholes and looking for patterns of connections, networks. They're more interested in looking how things work together. This is a radical departure from looking at the world as a great clockwork machine, which was the 300-year-old legacy we've had from Sir Isaac Newton's time. And so all of the new sciences, which include many different sciences of biology, chemistry, and physics, tend to, at a start, look for the whole of something and then try and understand the parts in terms of their relationship to the whole. That's the main distinction. There are others, but that's the really important one.
What is there to learn about organizations from understanding the new science?
Well, one of the interesting things is to realize how dominated our thinking about organizations is by the 17th century machine imagery. We have created in our minds the idea that organizations are well-oiled machines. And so we talk about tools and techniques and technologies, and we use a lot of machine imagery. Even more important than that, we have broken organizations into parts, and with the belief that if you have all of the right parts and you engineer it correctly, those things will work flawlessly. So we broke work into functions, we broke people into roles, we only wanted parts of people in the workplace. It's a very dominant imagery that once you start looking for it, you see everywhere. You see it in your language and you see it in the shape of whatever organization you're working in. What the new science is suggesting, which has also been suggested by people in other disciplines as well, is that let's think about organizations as living dynamic systems. Let's think of them as organisms rather than as machines and see what kind of new awareness and that would create and what kind of things seem important once you start looking at organizations as living systems rather than as complex, complicated, clanking machines.
When I read your book, I think one message that I got was sort of to let go of imposing a model of how organizations work, allow the organization to work, perhaps observe its unique elements and its relation and dynamic, and then perhaps only intervene as necessary.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's not quite as laissez-faire as that, but I think the big switch that any of us who are leaders, whether leaders of ourselves, our teams, or our organizations, have to make is to realize there's a huge difference between control and order. And the new sciences are showing us that, as one complexity scientist, Stuart Kaufman, said, in this universe, you get order for free. So the question that I was asking in the book is, how can we make use of order that's available rather than control, which is something we impose? We have spent hundreds of years, and in the past few years, we're getting better and better at thinking that the only thing that makes an organization work is our imposition of a structure and our sense of controlling everything, having our hands on everything. What the newer science is saying is that there are processes available in natural living systems that lead to emergent order, so that if you bring people together, if you connect them together, if they have a clarity of shared purpose, they will structure themselves in ways that work best. That's not really just letting go and letting order emerge, because as a leader, it's really important to make sure that people are brought together and that people are focused on a clear sense of defining their shared purpose. But the actual structure that emerges, I believe, should be a consequence of what those people feel works best. And that structure will change. We're starting to talk about much more fluid organizational structures, things that will come and go and that will be determined by the work that needs to get done and people's perception of what the real needs are. So that's a fundamental shift from control to order, an order that's found all around us in a lot of natural processes.
You talk about the Newtonian quest for predictability, and certainly every project manager, anyone who has had to meet a hard deadline in a complicated project, is constantly pressured to predict and control what's going to happen. And given that we still have our same old jobs, how do we meld this concept into the facts of today?
Well, I think the place we need to start is a shared recognition that prediction doesn't work. I mean, it's the source of enormous frustration and a lot of wasted activity. I don't know how many organizations, having created a 5-year plan, strategic plan, ever satisfactorily reached that plan because the environment changed around them or beneath them. We live in a world in which it is not possible to project direct cause and effect. If I do this, then that will happen. That's not the world that we experience. And yet we're sort of struggling with all of these very old planning models, which are based on a simple world and on cause and effect relationships that, in fact, just haven't held up in reality. So the first place to start, I think, is in recognizing our failures at prediction and control. And then the next place to go with that is to think together, okay, what's the best we can hope for? We're moving into a universe that scientists define as probabilistic. We can work with probabilities, but we have to get out of this belief or this need for certainty, because it is a very uncertain world which we inhabit. All of the turbulence, all of the chaos of the business environment these days is just pressing in on us, and for anyone to hold on to the belief that they can somehow understand that business environment enough to control it, enough to plan real consequences from certain activities, real cause and effect relationships, that is, it's a fantasy world to stay in those beliefs. And certainly as I go around talking to people, no one really believes in prediction anymore. We are still, as workers and employees, belaboring under these older models. There is much more interest in looking for models that deal with uncertainty, models that are probabilistic. Somebody said to me yesterday, you know, long-range planning in the U.S. now is 90 days. That's as far out as we can look. Well, there's something very true about that. So we are learning now, and there are a lot of theoreticians at work, how do you do strategic planning? What's the value of strategic planning in a world where you can't predict everything? And I think this is work that's just beginning, but it's clearly our future.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Margaret Wheatley. She's an associate professor of management at Brigham Young University and author of the book Leadership and the New Science. Now, Meg, you gave a list of changes in your book, changes in your own methods since coming to have an understanding of the new science. One of those changes is that you said you no longer argue with anyone about what is real.
Yeah, well, this is based on a much deeper Newtonian movement from Newtonian physics to what I call a quantum sensibility. One of the great discoveries at the level of subatomic particles is that any time we go to observe reality, we interfere with it, and that it's impossible to observe something independent of our acts of observing it. Every act of observation creates a disturbance, but we can never really know what's, quote, out there. And some people have taken this in a sort of postmodern sensibility to talk about that reality is something that we can never know except through our perception, and therefore it will always be particular to us. It's interesting to apply that to organizations because we spend inordinate amounts of time in organizations believing that we're right and someone else is wrong. We spend a lot of time in meetings trying to argue or persuade people that our perception is more correct than theirs, is more real than theirs. We hire experts who come in because we believe they have refined their perceptions and will give us the real information about what reality is. This is tricky stuff. I think the place for us to move organizationally is to stop arguing about what's right or what's real and instead get into conversations about what works. There are things that clearly work better at one time or another in our environments, and those are the things we want to be discussing, not arguing from a position that my belief or my perception is more correct than yours, but my belief or perception may be more applicable to current realities. And it's interesting because I often ask people in organizations, what would your life be like if you stopped arguing about who's right and who's wrong? And people tend to laugh. They start to realize how much of their time is spent in those kinds of discussions. If we can work collegially together to find out what works best right now for our organizations, I think it would really change a lot of the dynamics that are troubling us.
There's a quote in your book from Eric Jansch: to live in an evolutionary spirit means to engage with full ambition and without any reserve in the structure of the present, and yet to go and flow into a new structure when the right time has come. Having enthusiastically done this from time to time, I have received great criticism or sense tremendous irritation and blockage from the people who are trying to keep the current structure in place. Is that something that we can expect?
Yes, absolutely.
On to the next one.
We are, this state that Jansch describes has a new name. It's called the edge of chaos. It's that delicate balance between having a sense of who you are and what structure works, balanced with being open to change and being open to new information that will cause you to change. I find that we come ourselves out of 300 years of wanting prediction, wanting certainty. We don't want to be in this fluid, evolving state. We want to know what we're going to be like or what someone else is going to be like today, tomorrow, and forever. So it's a very uncomfortable place, this edge of chaos, and yet it's creeping up all around us, the sense that we live on the edge. People use surfing analogies now or skiing analogies. One critic of what he called postmodern times said, you know, this isn't the age of anxiety, it's the age of edginess. And we're all on this edge, and we don't like it. We don't like it individually. People around us certainly don't like it when we get into our fluid, willing to change and be unpredictable mode. So I think we just have to expect that.
So perhaps Apple should rethink its name for its new computer, a Newton.
Well, that's a good point, isn't it? Yes, well, we're still looking for certainty. I guess Apple would love a little more certainty in their market. So that's how they're getting it. They're naming their product Newton.
Well, just when we'd all gotten used to the idea that there could be chaos in the universe, you really kind of said there wasn't any chaos, only that which we were not yet able to observe its order.
Yes. Now, this, of course, you can approach from many centuries, thousands of years of spiritual wisdom, that there is a deep order to the universe. The science now is particularly the science of chaos, has looked at whole categories of chaotic systems and said that when you observe them over time and in a new kind of visualization where you can look at many variables at once and you can model the system in three dimensions, what you find is that from moment to moment, a system in chaos is unpredictable. That's the definition of a chaotic system. You can't predict what will happen next. So we still have that moment-to-moment feeling of craziness and unpredictability. But when you look at the behavior of that system over its evolution, over long moments of time, what scientists observe is that the system conforms to a boundary. It has its behavior has a shape to it, and its behavior never wanders outside of the boundaries of the shape. So you can predict the shape, but you can't predict individual moments. This has led to a new definition that chaos is order without predictability, which is a very paradoxical concept for us. We have always thought that order was something we created through our ability to control events or to control people or to control their behavior. What the science of chaos is suggesting to us is that you can have order without prediction. I believe at the level of leadership, what that leads us into is a paradoxical inquiry into the question of what should we be managing, what should we hold ourselves accountable for, but what could we let go of? If organizations have the same capacity to move chaotically at the level of individuals so that no two behaviors look the same, but that over time the organization still has a predictable shape to it, that would lead us to a very different way of managing. We would stop managing for compliance around behaviors. We'd stop having policies that dictate what people need to do in every situation. And instead, we'd think about how do we structure in this boundary for people, but then allow them to sort of wander within the boundary with their own autonomy. And I think these are very paradoxical and perplexing things to think about. I think they're also extremely important.
Part of the process of science is observing something you don't yet understand and getting comfortable knowing that you will see that phenomenon again and again. And perhaps that applies here as well. The point being that it's hard to think about letting people operate autonomously within this area,
right?
Because it doesn't really make a lot of sense to how we've been doing it. But if we can know at some level that it will work, then we can go ahead and do it.
Yes, and there are companies that are doing it, and there have been teams that have done it. We do have a lot of experiential data out there, but we haven't had the lens to look at it. We have I think a decent number of companies who've made a significant shift, and the shift is simply a realization that the people who work for them are adults. And as adults, they're able to deal with complexity, they're able to deal with ambiguity, they're able to make intelligent decisions, they're able to work with a desire to improve the health and viability of the organization. And that if you really treat people as adults, then you quickly create much more autonomy for them. I mean, you trust them at a whole different level, and you don't have to legislate or mandate their behavior and their reactions from moment to moment. So some of this is merely deciding to look for the experiential data that's already there. I also, though, I agree with you, Moira, that I've certainly found that until leaders learn to see that people can be trusted as adults and therefore can be let go of being managed moment to moment, until they have that experience, this sounds incredibly fearful to them. This feels like a total loss of control. One of the things that has to switch in our thinking is our belief, our trust, our faith that, in fact, order is available without hands-on control. I think that's the fundamental shift in this paradigm shift we keep thinking about or talking about. Is this a well-ordered universe we live in? I believe it shows evidence of that everywhere, gets along quite well without our interference, gets along better without our interference, some would say. So the nature of the belief shift that has to occur is, I think, this shift from things fall apart without my interference, which is the old paradigm, to things work well, order can emerge, and I need, as a leader, to learn how to foster the processes, how to create the processes that allow this order to emerge. And that is such a departure from our 300 years of prevalent Western thought that I know this is not easy for people. I've watched myself struggle with it and realize that as much as I know about the science or about order for free, that actually allowing a group to stay in chaos as a way of coming up with more creative solutions, that was a very fearsome experience for me for many months. It isn't now, because I've seen that chaos can lead to much greater levels of creativity in a group, but it took me a while to make the switch from what I knew to what I was able to trust. And so I think that this is something that's going to take many years for leaders to come to grips with.
My guest today is Margaret Wheatley. She's president of the Burkana Institute and a consultant in management issues. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Meg, you talk about self-organizing systems in the book. Tell us about that.
Well, self-organizing systems are this wonderful discovery in new science that won the Nobel Prize for Ilya Prigogine in the late 1970s. We have always believed that systems, when confronted with change, fall apart, that the only prospect for them is death and deterioration and a sort of wearing down and giving up of their energy. What self-organizing systems as a category of systems have shown us is that living systems, this includes human beings, when confronted with enormous amounts of change, will fall apart. But if you watch them, when they reach that point of falling apart, they have two choices available to them, not one. First choice is they can disappear and die. That's what we thought was the only choice. The second great revelatory choice available to them is that they possess an innate capacity to reorganize themselves so that they are better suited for the environment which has caused the change. Now, the interesting thing about self-organization as a model for organizations is it says that in order to get an organization to change, to adapt, to transform itself to a turbulent environment, that the organization needs to take in enormous amounts of information about what's going on in the environment, and that there may come a point when the information is so overwhelming to that organization that it can no longer maintain its present form. It can no longer work with its present structure. And then it will need to fall apart. It will need to plunge into a state of confusion or overwhelmness that I call chaos at the organizational level. And in that chaos, in that state of pure uncertainty, kicks in the self-organizing process. And what is then available through that chaos is a whole new order to the organization. The organization can reorganize itself so that it's much better suited to this environment which has shifted around it. Now, you can't get, this is the tricky part, you can't get to these adaptive and resilient and constantly changing organizations, ones that can really thrive in a chaotic external environment. You can't get those kinds of organizations unless you are willing to allow the organization or the team or yourself as an individual to periodically plunge into chaos. This is not something we value these days in management. Anytime we experience chaos, I think at the level of ourselves, our teams, or our organizations, we panic and believe that something has gone horribly wrong and that we better rush in there and save the group or ourselves or the organization from this confusion. So we try and structure ourselves out of chaos as quickly as possible. And what self-organization is saying, that when you structure yourself away from chaos, you prohibit the creativity that's available in the organization from surfacing. You actually prohibit the organization from coming to a solution that would be much better than the solution you have just structured in. I'm a real advocate these days for allowing chaos occasionally and at important moments to be present in our organizations, to support people in their confusion rather than in their certainty. Bert Nanus, who wrote The Leader's Edge, said, in these times, if you're not confused, you're not thinking clearly. And I think that's a great motto we all should adopt. We have to realize that out of our confusion can come our best creative ideas.
Another science concept which you talked about was fields. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the great understandings that has come to us in the 20th century from quantum physics is that space is not empty. In fact, it's filled with fields of energy. And I think this is an intriguing concept for organizations to think about what is the space of the organization and what's in it. If space is not empty, then we do possess the capacity to pick up what's in the field. Let's talk about the field of an organization for a moment. I believe the field of an organization is filled with messages about what gets rewarded here, what works here. If you want to succeed, this is what you need to be, or how you need to behave, or who you need to avoid. People pick up this information without even knowing it. And I believe that a lot of the inconsistencies or incongruencies in organizations, all of the things that get put under the current slogan of do we walk our talk or not, are feelings that people are picking up, a dissonance between what's written or put up on the walls of the organization and what they pick up from the field of the organization, which is this rich information that's out there about what's really real here, what gets rewarded. And there are some organizations who've contacted me who have felt that through very consistent and clear values, that they have created a field of congruency, that if people tune in, and we still don't know how we do this, if we tune into the field, we would pick up the same messages as are written in the value statement that's framed on the wall. And I believe that's a model for the kind of congruence we need to achieve in organizations. Once you have this field of information that is congruent with what you say you want to be, I think it's much easier for people to do what's necessary, to do what's right for that organization. They don't need as much training. Somewhere they are picking up this information without ever having learned it in our traditional linear fashion. And so it's an intriguing concept to me.
Meg, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Maura.
My guest today has been Margaret Wheatley. She's author of Leadership and the New Science, Learning About Organization from an Orderly Universe. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. You're listening to the best of Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Dr. Bart Kosko holds degrees in philosophy, mathematics, and engineering, and is author of the book Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic. I asked him how the thinking of Western philosophers has shaped scientific thinking as we know it.
It works like this. The language of science is math, and the structure of that math is logic. And that logic was first codified by the Western philosopher Aristotle about 2,300 years ago. And the essence of that logic is the black and the white, either or, what Aristotle called the law of excluded middle. The sky is either blue or not blue. And that's at the heart of modern mathematics, which is the language and methodology of science. So the worst thing that can happen is A and not A, the sky that's both blue and not blue, a contradiction. And that's at the essence of Eastern-type thinking.
Now, in your book, you talk about the relation of Aristotle and that type of thinking and the Buddha and their relationship to fuzzy logic.
And it works like this. At the heart of Aristotelian thinking, again, is the black and the white. And at the heart of Eastern or Buddhist or Lotzen-type Taoist thinking is the gray. And logically speaking, Aristotle, again, would say that the sky is either blue or not blue, whereas the Buddha or the Taoism would say the sky is both blue and not blue. So A and not A versus A or not A. And it turns out, in a mathematical sense, that this extreme either-or black-white stuff does hold, but only as a limiting case of the shades of gray. So in some sense, the more general case is this, call it the Eastern logic approach of the pink rose that's both red and not red, and only in the very extreme case is it all red or not.
So tell us now that we know that things aren't quite so crisp as we'd like them to be, or we have been striving for them to be. Tell us now, what's fuzzy logic, and where do we see it in our lives?
Fuzzy logic is a new branch of machine intelligence that tries to make computers think like people think. And it tries to do that by getting them to work with sloppy, common-sense terms. For example, a fuzzy air conditioner might have a rule in it of the form, if the air is cool, then turn the air conditioner down a little. And another rule, if the air is warm, then turn it up a little. And a notion like cool air is fuzzy, because all air is cool to some degree and at the same time not cool to some degree. And likewise, a motor command like turn down the motor a little is a fuzzy concept. All commands are little to some degree and not little at the same time. So what a fuzzy system does, it takes a lot of these rules of the form, if something, then something, and converts inputs to outputs. And that's a way we can control machines, in effect, make them smarter. So the net effect of fuzzy logic at the appliance level is to up the machine IQ, or up the mic of the appliance.
Now, there's been some negative reaction to the concept of fuzzy logic over the years, and I quote from your book Professor William Cahan of the University of California at Berkeley, and he says, "Fuzzy theory is wrong, wrong and pernicious. What we need is more logical thinking, not less. The danger of fuzzy logic is that it will encourage the sort of imprecise thinking that has brought us so much trouble. Fuzzy logic is the cocaine of science." What is all this upset about?
Well, I call that the binary reflex. Again, if you're trained in science, you've been taught that the hallmark of scientific reasoning is precision. And the hallmark example of that is mathematical reasoning, which is purely black and white. The number two is either even or not. Then to come along in the midst of that and say the world is gray, but science is black and white, and we need to make science gray too, is something of an upset. It's upsetting the apple cart in a very deep way. Now, adopting a black and white logic is not itself a logical act. It's a cultural act. It's a system level thing. In other words, you accept as a package deal one way of reasoning, but there's no formal reason for doing that. It's not something you prove mathematically, just do it. So if you've been trained that way, and if your instructors were trained that way, and so on, all the way back to Aristotle, this just seems utterly outrageous. So a claim to the fact that fuzzy logic is a cocaine of science is just what I think you would expect to hear from the status quo. And it's been the case. So the way it used to work is, once you would talk about fuzzy logic, and the ancient Greeks did in many forms of paradoxes. For example, am I bald or not? No, I pluck out a hair. Am I bald or not? No. And I keep plucking hairs, I never find that one hair that takes me from not bald to bald. But in those days, it was just dismissed as an anomaly of language. At the turn of this century, Bertrand Russell tried to reduce mathematics to logic in a book called Principia Mathematica, and failed when he found these same Greek paradoxes in the very structure of math. He used the example of a barber. There's a barber in a town who's a man and shaves all and only those men who don't shave themselves. So who shaves the barber? If he shaves himself, he doesn't. And if he doesn't, he does. And this is a version of the old Greek paradox of the liar. There's a liar from Crete who says that all Cretans are liars. Is he lying or not? If he lies, he doesn't. If he doesn't, he does. So you seem to have thing and not thing, A and not A at the same time. This stopped Russell and others in their tracks and opened the door, in effect, to fuzzy logic. Let the gray cat out of the black and white bag. And so, more as time progressed, the mathematical theory in this century of fuzzy logic has been developed, but the attack, the criticism of it, has been, well, what can you do with it? No applications. And then when from Japan the first applications began to roll in, the response was different. Interesting applications, but no theory. This is really just black and white reasoning or probability in disguise. And now we have, as time has passed, sort of a 1-2 punch. We have both the new theory, the mathematical theory of fuzzy logic, and several billions of dollars a year in fuzzy smart products coming from Japan and Korea.
Now, what are we seeing that's fuzzy logic oriented or driven?
You have to understand that Japan and Korea produce about 80 to 90% of the world's consumer electronics gadgets. And most of those have in them a microprocessor, a small computer chip. So in effect, what's happened is we've had a management reorganization at the chip level. Rather than building a new company, we've just reorganized. In other words, we just reprogrammed the chip. And so in that way, taking advantage of new sensor technology, we have fuzzy washing machines, camcorders, TVs, about every component of a car that you could possibly control, from the steering to braking to throttle control to fuel injection, suspension. Mitsubishi has an omnibus fuzzy system. And even the GM Saturn uses a fuzzy transmission in the United States. Several hundred gadgets like that have been put under fuzzy control.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Bart Kosko. He is a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California, and he is author of the new book, Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic. Bart, I have to say that it was important for me to read about fuzzy logic, which I have done before, and to think about fuzzy thinking at the same time. It's easier for me to think in terms of sort of fuzzy language and how we all talk to each other. You say, well, is the soup done? And it's like, well, maybe, you know, it's kind of, you know, is it warm enough for you? And you're used to that in your everyday life. When you go to program something on a computer or do some scientific project where you're trying to perform something, I suddenly get into a different mental mode, whether that's from my training or Western civilization, and I say, okay, we're going to reduce this to ones and zeros. You know, where's the cut? Where isn't the cut? And that's sort of been the methodology that we had. But when I start looking at it in terms of fuzzy thinking and where that is in my life and fuzzy language, it seems easier to look at the logic of it, of fuzzy logic.
Fuzzy thinking is the view that everything is a matter of degree. Fuzzy logic is the application of that fuzzy principle to science and math. So, for example, you can apply it outside of science and math to societal issues, worldviews, and the like. And I think in general, Moira, you brought up a duality that we all have between thought and action. Thought, I think, is inherently fuzzy. Action tends to be decisive, bivalent, all or none. For example, a jury. We don't accept a verdict of 80% guilty. We want the verdict to be all or none, where in fact maybe only 80% of the jurors really agreed, or a given juror only felt 80% confident of his or her decision. The candidate gets elected all or none. Everything gets rounded off for us, and that helps us get by. And likewise, at the computer level, right down to the chip level and the flow of electrons, the circuit or gate is either on or off. It's either a string of one or zeros. And that's a very efficient way to work with systems. On the other hand, it's not very accurate. If we say that the glass is only empty or full, you know, we leave out all these spectrums in between when it's partially full, and it completely breaks down when the cup is exactly half full because we can't round that off.
Why is it important that anyone other than scientists know about fuzzy logic?
I think it's important for several reasons. One example, if you think about the fuzzy principle, everything's a matter of degree in terms of our binary reflex of wanting to put people into groups. I think this explains what I'd call the logic of racism or of discrimination. We just love to put people into groups. You're white or you're black, you're left, you're right, you're Democrat, Republican, you hold this view, you're pro or anti-abortion, always falsifying, always putting people in pigeonholes. Whereas the fuzzy view is much more tolerant. You are left and right, Democrat and Republic. You, in effect, hold all views to some degree and don't hold them to some degree. And I think that's a very healthy thing.
In your article in the July 1993 issue of Scientific American, you say, the Achilles heel of a fuzzy system is its rules. What do you mean by that?
Is its rules. In other words, a fuzzy system is a set of fuzzy rules of the form, if the air is cool and turn down the air conditioner a little, that turns inputs into outputs. The question is, where do you get the rules? And the first approximation, you ask an expert, in this case, someone who controls an air conditioner. For example, in the city of Sendai, a city north of Tokyo, Hitachi developed about 60 fuzzy rules in conversations with experts and used that to control the subway. And now it completely runs the subway and outperforms the best humans and the best automatic controllers. The humans still run the subway, but in non-peak hours to keep up their skills. But what if there aren't experts to ask? Sometimes they're not, or the experts are unreliable. What you want to do in that case is have something that's data-driven that can watch an expert behave. For example, suppose you ask Itzhak Perlman how he plays the violin, how he converts the notes on the page to vibrations of the string. He could give you an answer, but it's not going to be the kind of answer you could program in a computer, fuzzy or not. So we want to have systems that learn from example like people do, and we have those. These are called neural systems. And a neural fuzzy system is sort of the frontier of the technology where the neural system recognizes patterns like cool air and then associates them into fuzzy rules, like if the air is cool, turn down the air conditioner a little. So, for example, there's a successful neural system on the market that can tell a good pap smear from a bad pap smear. But nobody knows how to program a computer to do that. In other words, we don't know how to draw the mathematical line between good and bad pap smear. So the idea is this. Modern computers are very good at crunching numbers. They're like high-speed adding machines. They're not good at all at recognizing patterns. They can't recognize your face in an image, for example. We just don't know how to explain that to a computer. People are great at that. Brains are great at pattern recognition. And these neural systems are pattern recognizers. And those patterns are inherently fuzzy. The boundaries are always vague. So the new neural fuzzy systems watch an expert behave and figure out the rules. A case in point is backing up a truck and a trailer rig in a parking lot to a loading dock. Now, experts do this all the time, but right now there is no known set of equations to back up a truck from any, say, jackknife configuration to the loading dock. It may exist, but we just don't know that. And this is the real advance of fuzzy systems, that they can model a system. Now, a system, again, is anything that turns inputs into outputs. And traditionally in science, you had to come up with some equations. And how do you come up with those? You guess at them. And the fact is, we guess very poorly. The guesses are very simple. The world's very complicated. If you have data, though, if you have experts who can actually back up the truck and trailer, and of course we do, you can just use that data, and the system will automatically figure out the implicit rules the experts are using. That's the advance, that as we paint pictures of the universe, we don't have to rely upon human psychology to come up with the equations. There just aren't enough Einsteins around to do that. We can be more data-driven. And the new theorems show that, in theory, you could replace all the textbooks and all the equations with fuzzy systems. Could you do it in practice? No, because we don't know the fuzzy rules. So that's why the Achilles heel of a fuzzy system is always its rules, how we come up with the knowledge and how we tune it.
So a fuzzy system, first of all, can only be as smart as the rules that are put into it.
Yes.
So if your rule is, if it's above 72 degrees, it's hot, and if it's below 72 degrees, it's cold, there's a pretty, that's a not very smart system, right?
Right. It's a very simplistic system, and the result will tend to be overshoot, undershoot. You'll bounce around this phenomenon we all experience driving the car, the air conditioner, or at home. It's always too hot, too cold. It fluctuates about the point. The way a fuzzy system works is it has lots of rules with these vague fuzzy sets, and they all tend to fire or activate to some degree at any given moment. And the system takes an average of all these, and it gives a nice, smooth response. So in the case of that Sendai subway system, the fuzzy system is smoother at braking and accelerating and decelerating than the best humans are, and precisely for this reason, and certainly better than the best automatic control system. These are equation-based systems. Someone tried to guess at the equations of braking. Mm-hmm. And it's a very rough approximation. It's always very jerky.
Now, the second part of what I think you were saying is that rather than having to come up with these rules themselves, saying first this, then this, then this, we can actually build systems that observe the behavior of experts.
Yes.
And get better. For instance, in the braking, one could see how a train brake by taking sensors and seeing how a human brakes the train. And then one could start to observe that feedback over time and come with a very smooth mechanism that a human couldn't react to in the kinds of reaction times it has. Is that what we're talking
about? That's the right idea. You learn from example and you learn the patterns of the expert. Case in point is Sharp has a neural fuzzy refrigerator coming out of Japan, and the neural system learns your patterns of opening the door, refrigerator door, how long you tend to open it, what time of day, how long you stand there, and so forth, and then uses that knowledge to tune its fuzzy rules more appropriately to your control, in other words, to adapt it to you. Another system under development is a neural fuzzy air conditioner in a car. Some more, you know, you may mean something different by cool than I mean by it. And we sit down and have some voice interaction saying, no, that's not, it's too cool, not quite cool enough, and so on. And you tune the system your way, then when I drive the car, I tune it my way. So it's user-dependent. It adapts to the individual. It's tuning the fuzzy sets, the fuzzy rules.
So the old, I knew you drove my car because you changed the mirror, will now be...
You got it.
I knew you drove my car because it's too hot.
It's too hot. You tuned the fuzzy brain of the thing, absolutely.
I like it. I like it. My guest today is Bart Kosko, author of Fuzzy Thinking, a new book which includes the computer science definition of fuzzy logic, but also examines its roots in Eastern and Western philosophy. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. When you intone the reader, don't confuse science with the scientists, you say the product of science is knowledge, and the product of scientists is reputation.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Henry Kissinger put it best. He said, the reason academic politics are so ugly is because there's so little to fight for. What is it that a professor does? Besides the teaching that most people think of, that's really not it. The game of science is a game of reputation. You know, you see that with physicists and winning Nobel Prizes. In engineering, for example, there are no Nobel Prizes given. It's more patent-based and honor-based in terms of technical publications. But that's a very intangible quantity. It's very much an ego quantity. I think of the product of scientists, at least hard scientists and engineers, as just a little dab of math, and wrapped around that is a tremendous amount of ego. And so when a new order comes along, a truly new idea like fuzzy logic that not just upsets the current thinking, but in effect a whole tradition of the Western civilization, you get a very, very emotional response. Max Planck, the founder of quantum mechanics, said that the way new ideas succeed in science is not that you simply persuade the opposition and they wake up and see the light, but rather that the old guard simply dies off, and in time a new generation comes along to whom the ideas are familiar and trivial. And that's been the experience, I think, of fuzzy logic and many other new ideas.
What is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and how does it relate to fuzzy logic?
Heisenberg's uncertainty principle is a trade-off between two quantities. One example is between the speed and the position of a car if you're driving in one lane in one direction. Usually it's given an example of an electron. So in other words, if the electron is moving very fast and you know how fast it's moving, you won't know with certainty where it is. So in the car analogy, then if you went fast enough, you would know where you were on the freeway. And if you did know where you were on the freeway, you would know how fast you were going. You couldn't, in effect, trust your speedometer. Now, it turns out in science that there are several of these uncertainty principles between what are called conjugate variables, not just between position and momentum in that case, but also in physics between time and energy and other things. Now, in engineering, right now as we speak, we're using another uncertainty principle between the time and frequency of a signal. This is operative on a radio transmission. It's operative every time you look at TV. It means there are limits to knowledge. And so when Heisenberg in the 1920s first found this at the quantum level, and at the same time H.L. Hartley and others at Bell Labs found it at the information theory level, it shook the world and told the world that there are limits to knowledge, that you'll never have total certainty even if all the facts were in. And in many ways that opened up science to fuzzy logic or multivalued logic. Heisenberg himself and others did explore multivalued logics, and John von Neumann and several other quantum theorists of different kinds of logics. But the idea was that you'll never have certainty, so the first thing they did is say the statements are not just true or false, they're either true, false, or indeterminate. And then indeterminacy itself took on degrees, so you had the whole continuous spectrum of fuzzy values. The historical point was we thought Aristotle's logic was right, was sufficient, and if you knew all the facts, you could completely predict the future, for example. Now, what the quantum uncertainty principle showed was even if you knew everything you could possibly know about an electron, you still wouldn't know all you could know about it. In other words, if you knew how fast it was going, you didn't know where it was, and vice versa. And there were many other properties that if you knew one, you wouldn't know the other. And that was, according to the theory, and that theory is still in place, that was the limits of our knowledge. So that made people doubt that you could say it was true, that the electron was going at such and such speed. It wasn't that it was true or false. It was that it was true or false to some degree. It was indeterminate. So that got people to doubt the old assumption of black-white reasoning.
American students are more familiar with mathematics and Western philosophy, if they're familiar with any philosophy at all.
Right.
Do they have difficulty grasping fuzzy logic?
I haven't found that. I teach a class where we have a course project. We develop a neural fuzzy gadget or system. You can simulate it, build a real thing, whatever you like, and the winner gets usually $1,000 prize, money put up by some firm. This year is put up by Motorola, and they're runner-up prizes, and then we have a video countdown from previous winners and so forth. I find students can do this very easily. It turns out it's very easy to use fuzzy logic. Now, the mathematics behind it can be complicated, but you don't need to know any of that to actually build a fuzzy system, and you certainly don't need any of that to use a fuzzy gadget. So I have found the response has been very enthusiastic, and in fact, the ideas, people are very enthusiastic to it. It's something new. If we go back to that other issue about the East and the West and our knowledge of Eastern philosophy, we in the West really have very little knowledge of Eastern culture. It's stereotypical, racial stereotypes. We think of chopsticks and rice bowls and body types and these sorts of things. But at the level of ideas, you know, why is it that there's a yin-yang symbol on the flag of South Korea? Yin-yang symbol, the balanced opposites, the black and the white, as opposed to Aristotle's version, that which would be all black or all white in some sense. I think the reason is at the heart of Eastern belief system, from Zen Buddhism to Taoism, in fact, to many others, is a tolerance of opposites, the unity of opposites, the balance of the shades of gray. And that's one of the very exciting things about fuzzy logic, and I think a lot of people kind of get turned on to it. It's a way in which they can, through technology, get a window on a different culture.
Japan's laboratory for international fuzzy engineering research, called LIFE, has an incredible board of directors. They are the presidents of Toshiba, Sumitomo Electronics, Nissan Motors, Nippon Steel, Minolta, Matsushita Electronics, and Fujitsu, to name just a few. Tell us about LIFE.
Okay. LIFE is a $70 million consortium. $70 million over 5 years, started in 1989. With about 50 companies, several of which you named, and now there's many more companies, and it's being renewed for the next 5 years. LIFE is an attempt to systematize fuzzy research in Japan, and to some extent it does that. Really what it is, Moira, is more the emblem of fuzziness in Japan. Fuzziness has been so popular in the different products, it doesn't need a LIFE. LIFE is sort of the, what we call the epiphenomenon. LIFE came after the successes of Hitachi with the subway system and the fuzzy washing machines and camcorders and so forth. Japan tends to do this. It picks a new technology area, throws money at it. And I have spent some time at LIFE and I have a lot of friends who work there. So in the West, it sort of scares us to see these big research centers put together. But I'm very skeptical of it. When I was there, you know, during the day, people, we talk technical, but the minute you hit the beer bars at night, it was nothing but naked politics and no company trusted the other, and they all rotated a few of their people through there, usually spying on seeing what the other people were doing. So I'm not convinced that sort of thing amounts to a heck of a lot of research. Again, most of the companies that sent people there already have ongoing fuzzy products and they patent these, and the patent war is a very fierce one in Japan, and that's something they're not willing to share. And yet there is the group effort, there are some projects they have pursued. In the south of Japan, there is an alternative institute called FLSI, or the Fuzzy Logic Systems Institute, run by one man, Professor Takeshi Yamakawa, and this is on the island of Kyushu, the big island, the southmost island, and this is the competitor to LIFE. And if anything, this has helped put more blood into the LIFE program. And it's been interesting in my travels in Japan to see these two feuding entities. Now, to the west and to the outside, it looks like just two different fuzzy institutes, and they cooperate. But up close, it just looks like the utter chaos of war.
You've proposed FAT, the fuzzy approximation theorem. Tell us, what's FAT?
FAT is a theorem that says, again, that in theory we can replace any equation with a set of fuzzy rules. So it's another way to model scientific reality. In practice, what it means is when we try to model a system, something that turns inputs to outputs, that system defines a curve that wiggles. Now, how it wiggles isn't important, and we usually don't know how it wiggles, but just to picture in your head, think of something that wiggles, a blue curve that wiggles. And the fuzzy approximation theorem says that each piece of fuzzy knowledge is like a blue blob. And you, if you have enough of these blobs, you can always cover that wiggling curve. And if you have lots of little blobs, you can get a better cover. And so just intuitively, you can always have this cookie-cutter cover of something that wiggles. It's like putting a lot of napkins on a freeway or napkins on a snake or something. You can, in theory, always do that. And that shows that, in theory, a set of fuzzy rules can always approximate or learn or estimate any kind of system, anything that turns inputs, outputs, whether it's in physics or economics or whether it's in electrical engineering.
So you may not get precisely the answer, but you would at least sometimes get all of the answers.
Yeah, the theorem says that you could always pick an error level and always satisfy that. In other words, you can always find a set of fuzzy rules that approximate the system as accurately as you please. Now, that's in theory. How you find that takes us back to that question of where do you come up with the knowledge? And that's the open research area, and there's hundreds of different ways of trying to find the rules, and I'm sure there'll be thousands more.
Dr. Bart Kosko is the author of the book Fuzzy Thinking, The New Science of Fuzzy Logic. You're listening to TechNation, Americans and Technology. Evan's perspective today is called Why Do Clocks Go Clockwise?
Clocks go clockwise because that's the direction that shadows on ancient timekeeping devices, sundials, go. As the sun moves through the day, the shadow cast by the upright piece of the sundial, the gnomon, moves in what we think of as clockwise, and early clockmakers emulated the movement of the shadow. Suppose civilization had arisen in the southern hemisphere. Now, I was taught at school, you probably were too, that civilization arose on the four great rivers, in Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq, near the confluence of the Tigris and Euphrates, in Egypt, on the banks of the Nile, in India, near the Indus, and in China, by the Yangtze. Notice, these are all in the northern hemisphere. If civilization had arisen instead on, say, the banks of the Plata or Plate River in South America, our notion of clockwise would be different today. There, to our northern conditioned eyes, the sun moves the wrong way through the sky. It goes from right to left. Even though I lived in New Zealand for 4 years, I never got used to that. For me, I'll always be biased to think that the sun moves the right way north and the wrong way south of the equator. The first clocks, sundials, were probably made by pushing a stick into the ground and marking the position of the sun's shadow throughout the day. For the Mesopotamians, or Egyptians, Indians, or Chinese, the shadow moved around in what we now think of as clockwise. When artisans living in the northern hemisphere made the first mechanical timekeepers, it was only natural to arrange for the hands to move in the same direction as the shadow on the sundial. So, if civilization, or at least invention of the mechanical clock, had occurred in the southern hemisphere, clocks would naturally go what to us would be counterclockwise. But of course, those counterclockwise clocks would actually go clockwise, right?
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation,
Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. TechNation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.